Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 3rd, the year 2000, and in the fireside room this afternoon, Phil Anderson does a session on borders and beliefs, U.S. policy and practice, vis-a-vis a faith-based vision for response to the uprooted migrants and refugees. An overview, who are today's refugees and internally displaced. Well, with that mouthful, let's go listen to Phil for his session. This is session or tape ANP 2000-1.
Thank you for coming. This afternoon we're going to do somewhat of a general overview of the situation of refugees and other forcibly uprooted people, internally displaced people and migrants. My name is Phil Anderson. I currently work with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. For the last 2.5 years, I served as the Washington representative for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. That is, I worked in Washington for LIRS, for the Lutheran Church, essentially, in the United States, before Congress, represented our interests before Congress and the White House, State Department, Immigration and Naturalization Service. I'm shifting now a little bit and I'm going to work on U.S.-Mexico border issues and the Caribbean situation, phenomenon of migration in this hemisphere. And we'll deal with that in other sessions this week. But today, we're going to take just a panorama view of what's happening around the world vis-a-vis refugees and internally displaced people. I'd like to begin with just a word of prayer and a psalm. Let's start with Psalm 22. Just take a moment to relax. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? From the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. Hear the groans and the cries of the refugees, Lord. Help us hear those groans and the cries so that people everywhere may become truly heirs of your promises to have life in all its abundance. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
The question really for me is, so what? So what about all of these refugees and internally displaced people? We know they're out there, we hear about them, we see things about them on CNN. In fact, it's now kind of the CNN factor, kind of what's going on TV. That sort of motivates what we know and understand and sometimes feel, and sometimes actually motivates us to act. But so what? So what if there are millions of refugees and internally displaced people? And what's in it for us as Christian people, people of faith, people of conscience, human beings? I mean, why should we care? I'm not sure I have the answers. Perhaps this afternoon we can dialogue about that a bit. But I think it's one of those places where we can say to the fact that there is suffering anywhere, we should, can, do, feel that suffering as part of God's body and Christ's body. And to the fact that, to the extent that the humanity of some is diminished, my humanity is also diminished. Just a little commercial on Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Has been in existence for about 60 years. Most all of its life in New York City, just moved last September to Baltimore. Has a staff of about 60 people, and it's grown up. Of course, it did a lot of work with refugee resettlement, post-Second World War, when a lot of international agencies came into being, including in this genre of refugees, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the agencies such as the United Nations, also Lutheran World Relief, agencies that do give humanitarian assistance to refugees. Last year, and maybe many of you have been involved in this, refugee resettlement, that is, some refugees around the world are chosen, a very small few refugees, bona fide refugees, to be resettled in other countries. And last year, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, through its affiliates all around the country, through congregations like perhaps some that you're in, resettled 13,000 refugees. Our agency resettled more than any other country in the world other than the United States itself. More than Canada, more than the Scandinavian countries, more than Australia, which are the other big refugee resettlement agencies. About 13,000 refugees. Not only are we in the business, as it were, of resettling refugees, but we are, I would say, a human rights agency par excellence. We're out there really scrapping when it comes to the vulnerability of people who are uprooted by violence, which sadly in this world there's still too much of. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees publishes a little magazine called Refugees, and they say the hot issue for a new millennium, how to help millions of the world's most vulnerable people. And I just want you to flash back in your mind, particularly around some of the big issue items like Rwanda and last year Kosovo, just the vulnerability, the pathos, the drama of that displacement. So we are a human rights agency. Where there is displacement, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, with a host of other agencies, Amnesty International, Lutheran World Relief, we're in there scrapping in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. And we do advocacy. We do public policy advocacy in Washington, D.C. Believe it or not, advocacy does make a difference. And some of you know that very well. It may be hard, we may not always get our word front and center, but we are in there doing advocacy. And I certainly urge all of you to be familiar with who are your members of Congress, your senators, your member of the House of Representatives. Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services publishes a handbook, and it should be available to your congregations, to your synods, to your local communities, to tell you what committees people are on. And they need to be hearing from you about issues of concern to us. Often they say, we just don't hear from our constituency, so we don't know what to do. So let them know. Speak out on behalf of refugees and internally displaced people. A couple of other areas, just very, very briefly, that Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service works in. First, asylum. Asylum issues. People who are, in a sense, what we call the forgotten refugees. Some people come to the United States or other countries who do not have the official status of refugees. That is, people who come in already documented, come into JFK Airport, and they have their document and go off to Fargo, North Dakota, or Seattle, or Omaha, or wherever it may be, and they get received by an agency like Lutheran Social Service and a congregation and a staff that puts them in a place to live and finds them work and gives them English as a second language. No, there are some people who essentially are also bona fide refugees. That is, they have a well-founded fear of persecution, and they have crossed an international border. They are a refugee, but they have come to our shores without that documentation. Maybe they have some false documentation, but they have come. And so we work a lot on protecting those people from return to their countries of origin where they may be subject to persecution. We also work with immigrants, asylees, and others who are non-U.S. citizens who are in detention. You've heard of some of the, like, America's Watch Network, Human Rights Watch Network. We have begun what's called the Detention Watch Network. Out of the prison population in the United States, which you know is growing, one of the largest sectors of, within the prison population, the fastest growing sector are non-U.S. citizens. And we're there working with a wide network of people in some of the detention facilities around the countries of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but also of county, municipal, state prisons that may have non-citizens. We also work quite a lot with unaccompanied refugee minors, which became an interesting issue this year around the question of how Elian Gonzalez was treated, and 4,000 other unaccompanied refugee minors were not treated. So we're in that business. We also do quite a lot in the area of employment. Once a refugee, let's say from Sierra Leone or Russia, any other, Somalia, comes to the United States, they need to get up and running, become self-sufficient as quickly as they can. We work, as well as other agencies, on trying to get them into the mainstream somewhat quickly. One little aspect of that that LIRS, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, is working very kind of cutting edge is, how does someone coming from, a woman coming from Somalia, Muslim culture, illiterate, has not worked outside the home, has basically, in a very patriarchal society, how does that woman begin to integrate into U.S. society? And we're beginning to do some studies on that and working with Somali women and other Muslim women come from a totally different culture and background. So that's kind of what we're up to. And now I'm just beginning some stuff on borders. Again, we don't know where we're going with that, but it's new stuff. Let me just do a quick survey around the world. I apologize for this map because it's quite small, but where are the refugees in the world? Let's just kind of tell me where, from what countries are refugees flowing at present? Or from, not necessarily flowing, but from where have the refugees come that are out there?
Bosnia.
Okay. Cuba. From Cuba. Okay. In terms of big numbers, Cuba is not among the big numbers. They have some indeed.
Southeast Asia,
but where?
Vietnam,
not so much anymore. It's been a while. From Burma, correct? Burma is right up there. And where do they go? Thailand, correct. Carmen?
From Central America, from El Salvador, from Guatemala.
Interesting. Are we getting refugees per se from Central America and Guatemala any longer? No, we're getting a lot of migrants. Mm-hmm. Big distinction. Mm-hmm. Why are they called migrants and not refugees? Anyone?
We don't accept refugees from these countries anymore.
They come and go. Many of them don't go.
Question of war, conflict, and it's essentially a determination, but they are considered to be economic migrants. Huh? That is, they are not vulnerable because necessarily they are not would not be persecuted necessarily by the five categories. Persecuted because of race, religion, class. There are two others, I'm sorry.
Political
opinion or membership in some group. Now, there are people that are challenging that, but those are the definitions at the present. But from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Nicaragua, from Honduras, they are not, from Mexico, they are not refugees. There may be exceptions, and those would primarily fall under the category of asylum seekers. Okay, there were a couple other. Yes?
Palestine.
Very good, very good. In fact, the Palestinians are the largest single category of refugees in the world today, about 3.9 million Palestinian refugees. Very, very important piece right now, because that's going to become one of the major issues in the Middle East discussions. Where do the Palestinians go? Yes?
Russia, Ukraine especially, we have many of them in the Vancouver, Portland area.
Okay. Very, very interesting. Some Russians are coming in the United States. In fact, it's one of the largest refugee admissions categories. It's about 30 to 40,000 Russians per year that are admitted to the United States. But do you know where most Russian from the former Soviet Union go?
Israel.
From the former Soviet Union? Well, some go to Israel, that's very good. And who pays for that, by the way? The United States is part of our foreign assistance package to Israel as we pay for the cost of former Soviet Jews to go to Israel. But most, I've got a map of this is actually Africa, which I will pass around. And you see the arrows. Imagine that for the former Soviet Union. It broke up 10 years ago. 1990, more or less. And this is just a quagmire of people, say a Uzbek that was in Russia or was in some other country, and all of a sudden you've got 15 new countries that did not exist before. And all of a sudden, for many of them, they became refugees outside their own land and not wanted. Once they were part of one nation, maybe involuntarily, but that was the fact, and now they are just moving all around. So Palestine, number one. Afghanistan, producing 2.5 million people. Iraq, slightly over a half a million, almost 600,000 people.
Is that per year?
600,000, that's the current number of refugees. That's not necessarily per year. The stat at the end of last year. Best figures that we can get. Sierra Leone, very, very small country. We'll talk a bit about it later. Sierra Leone, almost 500,000 refugees. We haven't heard much about it. Somalia, interesting, because it was in 1990 that displacement really started. And still today, 425,000 refugees. The Sudan, 425,000 refugees, mostly in other parts of Africa. Yugoslavia, and what do we mean by Yugoslavia today? What is Yugoslavia anymore?
Serbia
and Montenegro. Still 390,000 people from just those two republics outside of Yugoslavia. And one other.
Rwanda?
Angola. Unbelievable, because that is a war somewhat like, I liken it to Nicaragua in terms of U.S. Cold War interests. And it should have been resolved long ago. It is really a hot button item at the moment. Who then receives refugees? In terms of volume of refugees?
Canada?
No.
Australia?
In terms of the highest numbers, think around the world. Canada, and not the United States, surprisingly.
Germany?
Scandinavia is not a lot of them.
Pakistan, number one. Pakistan. 2 million Afghanis. 2 million Afghanis in Pakistan. And these are still considered refugees, you see. They are considered refugees. Essentially, those who come to Canada, those who come to the United States, are no longer refugees. Huh? They have, for a year, they have the status of refugee, but they are being resettled. They are no longer refugees. They can finally rest. Huh? They are no longer refugees. The 2 million Afghanis in Pakistan, they have no permanent solution yet for them.
And do they want to go back home?
Most refugees do. And most refugees will. Most refugees will. What would be a second most possible option for a refugee if they don't go home? Where?
Ukraine. Where their friends and family.
Most become residents one way or another in their adjoining country. And what is the most hospitable continent for receiving refugees in the world? Africa. Africa has absorbed countries in Africa like Tanzania, Kenya, Guinea right now, Ivory Coast. They receive more, far more refugees than the United States. They receive. Now, there are some distinctions. Tanzania, for example, from the early 1960s, Rwanda, Burundi had wars, and some other countries in that immediate area fled to Tanzania. People went there, big cities virtually sprung up. Lutheran World Federation was involved in receiving the refugees, the host government of Tanzania welcomed them, protected them, gave them assurances, but what won't they give them? They cannot ever become a citizen. Even if you are a child that was born in a refugee camp of a Rwandan or a Burundi, you will not become a Tanzanian. That's up to now. Could change, but that's the case. It's not the case in some countries. Second largest absorber of refugees is the Russian Federation. That is Russia itself absorbing about 1 million people from other provinces or other states of the former Soviet Union. Jordan, about 800,000 Palestinians. 800,000 Palestinians. What's going to happen after a state of Palestine is declared? It could be declared this year. 800,000 could go back to Gaza, where the ratio of already the ratio of refugee to non-refugee is 1 to 2. That is, there is one refugee for every 2 Gazan. And if 800,000 come back, it's, yes.
And I think that the population of Jordan is over half from Palestine.
From
Palestine, I mean Palestinian refugees.
Interesting, right. And then somebody mentioned Thailand receiving a lot of the Burmese. Again, we don't hear much about Burma. So part of what is out there in the CNN factor is that there's part of the CNN factor is we don't hear about something. CNN doesn't have a camera, can't get a camera into Burma. Huh? It's hard to get a camera into Burma.
Bill?
Yes?
When you say that they're received into these other countries, then is it the same process where they're given rest and they're no longer considered refugees? If they're received into these countries, then their status changes?
In terms of the conditions, and there are a lot of variances, and we may get into that. Let's talk a little bit. Let's do a little comparative study right now. Because there is, under the United Nations, a convention on refugee status. And like any other convention of the United Nations, some nations subscribe to it and others do not. And even if some nations subscribe, then there are a lot of variations in terms of the level of aid that can come in and sort of the dynamics of the struggle on the other side of the border. Oftentimes, countries will, for a time, not really want to declare these newcomers as refugees because that kicks in a certain amount of responsibility on their part and on the part of the international community, including the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So they will say, well, they are temporarily welcome in our country. We'll give them a status of guests or of visitors, and we hope that they will go back when the conflict on the other side of the border subsides. And that does happen. And it happens kind of in and out of different conflicts. I was involved in a situation in Guatemala once, in southern Mexico. It was during the war in the early 1990s, in which there was a displacement of a whole community of Guatemalans into Mexico. And Mexico is not a subscriber to the UN Convention on the Rights of Refugees. Although the UN was working in Mexico, and they wanted to ignore these people now inside Mexico, and therefore they were not providing emergency assistance to these people. And it was about 600 people, if I recall. And so I was working in Guatemala at the time. Some of the people in the UN said, Felipe, why don't you go down there, find these refugees, which I did. I flew down in a chartered plane, a little Cessna, and found them under the canopy of the forest, landed in a cow pasture, was greeted by the army, and we made a little report, sent it back. I sent a report to Geneva. I was working for the Lutheran World Federation. I said, well, since the United Nations is not responding to these, I guess we'll have to cough up the money to provide food and health care. The next day, the UN said, thank you, Felipe, but we'll take care of it. In other words, we embarrassed them to take a step forward to attend to these refugees. So, but that's in a very fluid situation where, obviously, at that time, there were already approximately 50,000 Guatemalan refugees in Mexico, in southern Mexico. But this group of 600, they didn't want to include. So that, there's always those kind of dynamics going on. I want to do just a quick recall, if you will, and look at the situation of Kosovo. Put your mind into replay for a minute and go back to the Kosovo crisis. And then put on one side Sierra Leone and what you kind of remember about Sierra Leone over the last year, because things were going on precisely at the same time. Displacement of people. And we might call the Kosovo situation bombing in the name of humanity. In fact, President Clinton said on March 24th, 1999, just a little over a year ago, that ending this tragedy is a moral imperative. And NATO began to bomb. I'll never forget the date of the beginning of that bombing, March 24th, 1999. March 24th is the day that Oscar Romero was killed in El Salvador in 1980, Bishop back then. And March 24th is sort of etched in my heart, I guess, as kind of a sacred day. But that's the day that NATO bombing began. From 30,000 feet up, we were out to destroy the military-industrial infrastructure of an army that was working on the ground with small arms and door to door. And there we were, 30,000 feet up, dropping bombs. At the same time, Sierra Leone, and we might call, does anyone at all recall Sierra Leone or happen to know much about Sierra Leone? Over the, yeah, you do. Good. Tell me. What, how would you characterize that?
Chaos. It's rebel groups fighting amongst each other against the government, and they use the practice of terror against children and women mostly. I mean, they kill the men and then do what they will to children.
Yeah, exactly. And where does that fit on the CNN factor?
Pretty low.
Pretty low. Or in fact, until just somewhat recently, just totally off the TV screen. Maybe we'd call it off the map and out of sight and out of mind. So we had this moral imperative, and why would the United States and the European countries consider that a moral imperative? What were really the factors at work there? What would be the rationale, foreign policy rationale for getting engaged around Kosovo and not Sierra Leone?
Stabilizing southern and central Europe so that the crisis wouldn't spread to the other countries that were NATO members.
Stabilizing southern Europe and so the war wouldn't spread to other countries. Did we bother to stabilize Sierra Leone?
Well, it's NATO, but you're right.
And so the war wouldn't spread to other countries. I want to ask, so what's the distinction in the rationale then? Yes?
Race.
Very good. Very
Maybe
good.
Also,
and to say more about that, please. Or race. Let's follow up on the race.
Yeah, I'm going to say the same thing. To me, it's obvious that the blacks didn't have a voice in our media, and it doesn't matter how democratic CNN wants to be. You know, they would rather give the voice to Kosovo, and even though the circumstances are very similar or worse in Africa, we didn't have a voice as people of color.
Aha. Uh-huh. I hope these work. Anyone know? So you're saying that a voice. So you need a voice, you need kind of a constituency. Somebody was out there raising their voice, let's help these people, but that vis-a-vis Sierra Leone, who's the voice, who's the constituent for the Sierra Leone? But who's the constituent for Kosovo? What's the driving force for the Kosovars? Yes?
Eight years ago, in fact, when the whole situation in Yugoslavia was just beginning to bubble up, a woman who I happen to know through my job's husband was Yugoslavian, and she was extremely upset about the situation there. So we have, I think the difference is we have more of our people living in the United States with roots back to Bosnia and Serbia. I met, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, in Washington, D.C. We were, the maid who came to change our bed was talking about her family in Sierra Leone. Now, the woman whose son was in my son's class is mainstream America. The woman who was the maid at the hotel was an immigrant here from Sierra Leone.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, we are getting some Sierra Leone people now in the United States, and it'll be interesting where that goes.
She was a maid, you know, she was an immigrant maid.
Right.
A homeowner working in American.
Okay, yes. First, go ahead.
The money factor here.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of the Yugoslavian people with that ancestry in this country are doctors and attorneys and people of education and means and with a voice.
Yeah, okay, so there, yeah, in fact, from Yugoslavia, there has been a lot of, from the former Yugoslavia, there's been a lot of migration, there is a constituency, there certainly is some history, and some recent history at that, That is the Serbian, Croat, Bosnian, Herzegovina experience, which was sort of haunting us, right? We were sort of haunted by that. And so we sort of were driven, well, it's not going to happen again. Milosevic, we've got to stop him finally. But what's interesting about that is that that worked differently in Africa. Remember in 19, one of the last things that George Bush did was that he sent troops to Somalia, and it was almost one of the first things that President Clinton inherited, and it was under Clinton then that these Marines were killed and they had to pull out. But what's quite interesting, at the end of the Cold War, Africa takes on a totally different significance, because this used to be the battleground, one of the battlegrounds of the Cold War between the former Soviet Union and the Western Bloc, Europe and the United States. We all battled for that. That's why there's a war in Angola even today and many other areas. After things broke up in Somalia and after the United States pulled out, and it was just tremendous. I had just come back from work in Central America, then was working for Bread for the World, and our focus at the time was on the Horn of Africa and hunger in Africa. And I was involved in some conversations with State Department people, and I said, well, why aren't we responding more assertively here? And I had some ideas how we could respond to disarm the young boys with the guns. And he said, well, frankly, Africa has lost its real estate value. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter anymore what takes place here. It doesn't matter. You know, we are, and the United States has not had a huge colonial history in Africa as the Europeans have. We don't have that affinity. So once the Cold War was over, hands off. It no longer has real estate value. So, and that applies to the Sudan as well. A quote from one of the, I would say he's like the Oscar Romero, the Medardo Gomez from El Salvador, from the southern Sudan, a Catholic bishop, whose name is Makrom Max Gassis. We raise our voices and cry, that is the Sudanese people. We are forgotten and marginalized. Is it because we do not live in Europe as the Kosovars? Is it because we have a different skin color and different physical features? Is it because we do not have any strategic importance? And it's pointing a finger, as it were, and it's raising that question, my God, how long? So there is obviously a disparity in response. Now, there are two other situations, and I know time is flying here, and I want to get to a couple of things around internally displaced people and then have some more time just for open discussion. We're looking at situations where the international response, I would say, is tremendous. It occupies us at many, many levels. And then on the other extreme, where we have refugees, internal displacement, human tragedy and drama, and virtually no response. Kosovo, Sierra Leone. I was just at a briefing in Washington, D.C. With a major delegation. It was like in March of this year, one of the first delegations to go in to Sierra Leone, a multifaceted delegation, United Nations Development Program, World Bank, USAID, a number of other UN agencies. There was a peace agreement on Sierra Leone last May or June called the Lomé Peace Accord, brokered in large part by the United States. Part of that deal, and Jesse Jackson to some extent was involved, and I admire Jesse quite a lot. On this one, it's really a tough call, because what we did there was we negotiated into the peace agreement. You talked about the rebels that were conscripting young kids and massacring and mutilating people. About 20,000 civilians have died, but 500,000 refugees, people have gone outside, about a million internally displaced people. But the most bizarre and macabre is that the rebels, Fode Sanko and others, his roof, the Rebel United Forces, they cut off the hands of people and the arms and sometimes the legs. Now, for a lot of communities, particularly in developing countries, that's why landmines are so bad. To be mutilated like that leaves you not only useless in terms of your physical capability in many ways, not totally, but also you become, you're dependent on others. And so you become a burden to the community. You're also marked. You know, there's something wrong. Why was your arm cut off? Who are you? You know, you must have been against the rebels, so you are marked forever. So this UN team came back and they said, you know, we met with everybody and we shook hands with everybody who had hands left. Wow. I mean, because there are just a lot of people. Now, the United States is looking at resettling refugees. And who do we often resettle? Well, we resettle, it's nice to resettle a nuclear physicist or somebody like that. It's a little more difficult to bring into your community a child who doesn't have an arm or two arms or no legs or maybe is HIV positive from Uganda. Very difficult choices, decisions that have to be made. And in our culture right now, in our political culture, where we don't want people to be welfare dependent, you know, it's really difficult. And they become the people that go down to the bottom of the list. Unless voices like ours say, no, they too are God's children, heirs of the promise. Two other case studies. East Timor, we won't go into these in much detail. Since 1975, Indonesia has occupied East Timor. It's been a disaster. The East Timorese have been fighting for self-determination. Finally, Suharto resigned, new president calls, to the surprise of everybody, elections. Last August, there were elections. The issue was sovereignty, which meant basically remain part of Indonesia, or independence. And it was either yes or no. A yes vote was for sovereignty. 98% of the people showed up to vote. They voted no to sovereignty, 78%, which was yes to independence. The reaction by the Indonesians was to come in and destroy. Destroy, destroy, destroy. And you remember some of the scenes there. Again, CNN could not get in very well. There were some courageous reporters in Indonesia, but it was very, very, very dangerous for everybody. One of the worst things about war these days are drugs, and they're not the, you know, the high-end drugs, but even just kerosene, gasoline, paint, glue, anything you can sniff and will just go berserk, huh? And a technique used often among some of the militias and paramilitaries is to just put your troops on that, and they just go nuts. And a lot of that was used, so the city of Dili was destroyed. It took a while. Finally, the UN says we need to intervene. Australia sent some troops, began to put things back in order. Massive displacement of people, but thankfully, people were allowed to return. So you have two situations. You remember also June 10th, 1999, the NATO forces and the Serbs on the border with Macedonia agreed to a peace agreement, the terms of a settlement, and it wasn't more than 24 hours before the Kosovars began to go back in tremendous numbers. Before, you know, the humanitarian assistance and the minesweepers could get out front and prepare the way, the Kosovars went back. Same thing with East Timor. The Timorese started to go back. So the goal and the result of both Kosovo and East Timor out of a humanitarian rescue, really what was going on was the strengthening of a victim's, a society's political aspirations. The Kosovars for independence, the East Timorese for independence, from governments that had previously oppressed them. So it's not just humanitarian often. There are some other things going on. One other scenario out there that we don't see a lot of, Chechnya. Not a lot of footage on Chechnya, right? Why is that?
Trying to keep the balance with the Russians.
Russia is the big factor. So what about Russia?
Don't want to offend them.
Don't want to offend them?
Because? The nuclear arms treaties are due.
Powerful nation. Anything else? Where do they exercise some of their power in the world? In New York City, in a big building. At the UN, they sit on the Security Council. How do you get something passed through the Security Council if there's a country that sits on the Security Council that doesn't want intervention by the outside? So a very interesting factor. Photo in the New York Times. The city, what was the capital of Chechnya? I can't remember.
Grozny.
Absolutely destroyed. I mean, just like pictures, images I remember out of Second World War, the bombing of Dresden. Just unbelievable. Recently, as you remember, the Russian troops came into Grozny, and the Muslim Chechnya fighters that were in there, in their flight, and the Russians and probably the Muslim fighters had minefields all around. I mean, this is a desperate, desperate situation. And in their flight, some of the Muslim Groznian or the Chechnyan fighters would run across minefields and know that they were going to be blown up, and they would say, "For Allah, for this is for Allah." They know that they would be blown up, so that behind them, their comrades could come and find a path out through the minefields. Tremendous situation. So the world must ask itself, why do we let some populations die while for other populations we jump to the rescue? One humanitarian aid worker in Kosovo is said to have said, it's really obscene the amount of humanitarian aid coming into Kosovo and Macedonia. We are tripping over each other. We are competing to provide assistance to people. That was at the same time that no agency other than Doctors of the World, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. We could not get medical doctors to go to Guinea to attend 500,000 refugees from Sierra Leone. I was at a briefing in the White House at the time of the Kosovo crisis. President Clinton, Bill Cohen, Madeleine Albright, Sandy Berger, head of the National Security Council. And they trotted out kind of a new plan that they were going to have U.S. citizens could call into an 800 number to contribute money to the United States government for the Kosovar situation. Agencies such as Lutheran World Relief and others fought that. They said, no, you know, that is just going to exacerbate the problem. It's good for the United States government to get into the sort of the funding of projects like this is crazy when there are multiple agencies out here that can do the work. Plus, given situations like Sierra Leone, it is a mockery of what's going on, and we stopped that in its tracks. On the other hand, corporations were then given opportunity, like Microsoft and other companies, to send their wares there. And that's where a lot of companies could dump, literally, used clothing, shoes, you name it. And so plane loads of stuff was going to Kosovo, and part of the task of humanitarian agencies had to be, where are we going to store this stuff? Where can we dump it somewhere else because it's getting in the way? We don't have enough trucks. We've got to get food to people, and here we are trying to get popsicles to kids. So really interesting disparities.
Phil?
Yes.
How much communication is there between the private aid agencies in terms of, you know, assessing where the needs really are and responding effectively?
Excellent question. There is, I'd say, a good amount of coordination. It can't be absolute, and of course, each agency maintains its own independence, and it moves according to essentially its own criteria. But there is this conglomeration of agencies called Interaction, of which the president of Lutheran World Relief, Catherine Wolford, up to about a year ago was the chair of Interaction. So we're very involved as, say, Lutherans and others, you know, U.S. Catholic Conference, Methodists, you name it, and Oxfam's, the, you know, Save the Children, all of those agencies are in there, CARE. They meet, they have committees, they meet regularly. I would attend meetings every 2 weeks. Interaction, State Department, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. Absolute coordination, no, because it's impossible. It's got to get worked out on the ground. So essentially what happens, say in a Kosovo situation, you get into an area, whoever gets there first, and after a few days you kind of figure out who's there, you set up a lead agency. Set up a lead agency for communication, lead agency for food, lead agency for registering people, lead agency for healthcare, sanitation, and the like. So you begin to sort that out as quickly as possible, get your task forces going, and the best you can do. And then you have meetings, and those meetings might be scrapping things out. You know, I want to do this, I want to do that, or I've got, and they're very useful. I've got this information, you know, so you complement each other. People work extremely hard at that. It gets to be one of the, I mean, you're working 18, 20 hours a day in crises such as Kosovo. So it's tremendous, huh? We've got about 5 minutes to wrap up, and I want to just say, let me hand out maybe a couple of you could do me a favor, just hand these around. And if you have extras, please give them back. I'm just showing the complexity of refugee flows in Africa alone as of last year. And you could duplicate that in some other areas, particularly in the former Soviet Union. We haven't touched much on internally displaced people, but what's the difference, an internally displaced person and a refugee?
Weren't they refugees in their own country?
Very good.
Wouldn't that be what they're...
Very good, refugee in their own country, but there's a significant difference. The international community doesn't quite kick in the same way. Right. Yeah, you don't see them in some ways because they're not crossing this international border. Certain things like the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, they don't have a mandate necessarily for these people. Now they're beginning to get a mandate. They're beginning to crowd that because, in fact, in terms of raw numbers today, there are more internally displaced people than there are refugees. There are about 14 million refugees, bona fide refugees today as we sit here. And that number goes up and down, you know, by the decades or whatever. 17 million, roughly, internally displaced people. And I want to, just given the brevity of time here, focus just on one area, kind of give it away. In this hemisphere, where is there a big internal displaced problem?
Colombia.
And it's going to get worse, folks. Colombia, I don't have a big map of Colombia here. I used to work in Colombia 5 years, and I was in the central part of the country, Bogota, let's say it would be about here. Comes down in Brazil and Ecuador down here and Peru and over here Venezuela. So it borders on a number of countries and Panama up here. Here you can get, you know, the last week Congress just approved $1.3 billion worth of assistance to Colombia to fight the
drug war.
Wow, what's that going to do? What's that drug? Most of that is going to be targeted to the southern part, Caquetá and Putumayo down here. This is a very southern border to fortify the police and the military. We're going to send lots of helicopters. 250 U.S. military advisors are in the package. Senator Paul Wellstone said, let's take... What's the problem? Drugs. Okay, let's take, since it was clear that some money was going to go, Senator Paul Wellstone from Minnesota said, let's divert some of that money and put it toward, drug treatment programs in the United States. More effective, cost effective to treat drug users than to treat drugs coming in the United States. That's a proven fact. Went down, 11 votes to 89, I guess, went down. Everybody wants to go to war in Colombia, in U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. Last year, we got word that there was a Plan Colombia. There's President Andrés Pastrana of Colombia, just been in office a couple of years, and you know, kind of the darling of U.S. Policy and in Colombia of late, and good relations now with the U.S. We want to support him, and all of a sudden this Plan Colombia showed up. And funny thing, there were no copies of Plan Colombia in Spanish. Who wrote it?
CIA.
It was written by the United States. In the Plan Colombia, it contemplates that we know that this is going to increase fighting in the southern part of Colombia, and that will displace 50,000 more people in the short run. That will displace 50,000 more people. Part of the goal will be the eradication of coca fields and the like. The people in Ecuador now are saying that's going to force people across the border into Ecuador and Brazil, because they not only will it destroy their coca, you know, if you put Agent Orange or whatever their herbicides on, you can't grow cacao, you can't grow coffee, you can't grow anything. And it's going to pollute the rivers, the streams. So we've got a real dilemma going on here. The Europeans have been doing some negotiations, some mediation, the Germans and the like, but watch that one. It's going to be a disaster. We've tried in the Lutheran Church to raise this issue for nearly 3 years. Got a little working group going in Washington, D.C. We're not making much headway. And we are now getting many, many more Colombians coming to the United States for the moment. And some are applying for political asylum and getting it. Some are going into areas like Panama, and they're being pushed back by the Panamanian, because some of those are, this is a guerrilla area up here. Last November, I was up in this area, and I tell you, it's tough. The churches, these very, very poor evangelical churches are doing, I mean, they are producing miracles out of nothing. I don't know how they do it, but they're opening up their doors, and it's just fantastic. In Bogota also, the Lutheran Church, they're doing stuff, the Presbyterians.
The faith of the people is unbelievable. Yeah. I think
you want to talk about Colombia, here's a Colombia.
I just think I learned so much from being with those people, and their faith is what I think is driving them.
Right.
Now, there are supposedly up to 20,000 Russians in the small city of Spokane, Washington. Now, are they refugees?
They may have come to the United States having been refugees in the former Soviet Union, considered refugees. They were admitted to the United States under our refugee law. And it's primarily hosted by the Jewish community in the United States to get out for Jewish people from the Soviet Union because of persecution. Now, it's interesting, last decade, it used to be that virtually all of those were Jews. Now about, I think it's even more than 50% are evangelical and some Pentecostal Christians. And they are indeed being persecuted. The ironic thing is that, I mean, the Jewish community, rightly, puts a lot of pressure on the State Department to keep those numbers, 30,000, I think, or so per year coming. But they can be, say, if you're living out here, you can have what they essentially be processed to be admitted to the United States, and you hold on to that until you feel like traveling.
Well, that what determines that they're coming to Spokane?
Perhaps they have family members there. In fact, the taxi driver that picked us up the other day in Seattle was from Russia. Very likely they had. When you get one, you'll get a second, then you'll get four, then you'll get eight.
But they are very religious people.
Uh-huh.
They have built churches.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Evangelicals and Pentecostals. Yeah. Okay.
It's
sure. Right. Very good. I mean, there are a lot of shifts, and we unfortunately have run out of time. So
don't like to learn the English language, because you talk to them in the store. You know, you see them and they look like they need help. And so I have several times gone up, can I help you? And they say, no, I speak English. They can say that. And there is an apartment house in the same area as I live. And they want the young Russians to teach them, the older ones, the language.
Yeah.
They don't want to go to the school that we have.
Well, like any immigrant family, and refugees are sort of a subset of immigrants. It's the second generation that will capture that language. And usually the primary person that comes in, it's an investment in the future of their children. So it doesn't really, you know, they'll be the ones that are going to suffer a lot. The language question and the cultural change, and the second generation will suffer that too for a bit. But it's an investment in the future. In fact, a lot of our refugee policy and our immigration policy is premised on that. We really, in Canada particularly, they want to grow their population, so they'll bring in people from all over the world. Why are they doing it? For the second generation. Because the first generation provides them low-income labor, low-wage labor. But it's that second population, second generation,
the kids.
It's amazing
that they have people back in Russia, because they go to garage sales and everything, and they pick up big boxes and send back to them clothes and certain foods. It's amazing.
Very good. Well,
I was just going to say, my grandparents came from Finland, and on both sides of my family, and my mother and father didn't, born in the United States, did not speak English till they went to school. They were living. And they weren't, that my relatives didn't come as refugees, but just as immigrants. But again, they settled in the Finnish community, lived in the Finnish community. My grandmother, to the day she died, spoke very poor English.
Right.
So we all came from that.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Just two more little quick words. If you could help this year, in the last 8 years since President Clinton came to office, the refugee admissions to the United States have gone down 40%. We admit less refugees now for resettlement than 8 years ago, 1992. From 130,000, we're down to 80,000 refugees out of this 14 million that are out there. The United States admits about 80,000. Part of the issue is money. A lot of that has to do with the Balanced Budget Act, of course, but there is money for some things, like we can now put $1.3 billion into Colombia. If you could write urgently to your member of Congress and ask them to increase the appropriations for refugee admissions, we're down to the wire on that. Month of July, August, that'll be set. That's for the year 2001. Secondly, just keep your eyes and ears attuned to human rights situations, and let's see if we can turn this disparity around from the Kosovos on the one end and the Sierra Leones on the other, so that all can participate as heirs of the promise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.